From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
15 years ago this coming month, there was a spill from a freighter in the North Pacific. But instead of oil, close to 30,000 ducks and other assorted rubber animals slipped into the ocean. The quest to learn what happened to them revealed a lot about not only the water currents and what sort of detritus is in the North Pacific, but also about the impact of globalization, the fate of the wilderness, and even the perils of childhood. Donovan Hone has chronicled the surprising journey of these little yellow duckies in an article for the January issue of Harper's Magazine. He's called it Moby Duck or the Synthetic Wilderness of Childhood. I'm very pleased he could join me again on the show. Hi.
Hi.
So what happened here? Was the sea especially rough?
It was actually one of the first questions I tried to answer was what exactly the weather conditions were like on January 10th in 1992. And I was surprised that it was hard to get an exact answer. But somebody at the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, a meteorologist, managed to send me a page of cryptic numbers that measured wave heights and wind speeds that had been sent in by ships and buoys in the vicinity of the spill. And I was able to come up with a reasonable guess about that the waves were approaching 40 feet tall in the vicinity of the spill.
And these things were in containers on the deck, exposed to those waves?
My understanding is that on most container ships, there are a portion of the stack is below the deck, but a portion is above it. And so, yes, they were exposed.
And how did these rubber toys escape?
Well, first of all, I should probably say, because I make maybe even too much of it in the piece, that they're what we think of as rubber duckies are actually plastic. The term is residual from back when we used to actually have real rubber ducks. But what happened was the ship rolled. We think probably about 55 degrees, which is a steep angle to roll, so that the stack of containers would have been more horizontal than vertical. And 12 containers snapped loose, and one of them contained the bathtub toys. We don't know exactly when they spilled out. Is it in the collision with other containers? Is it as it hits the rail of the ship going overboard? Is it as the container sinks to high pressure depths, but at some point the container opened and discharged its contents onto the North Pacific.
And we're talking about a large container if it had 30,000 of these floating animals. Would anyone on board have noticed the time of the spill?
We know that the captain recorded it in his logbook. Yes, they noticed, definitely.
Any idea of how often spills of this sort occur?
The estimates are vague, but range from 2,000 a year to 10,000 a year. And even the high end might be a conservative estimate because many of the spills go unreported. So for all we know, there could be even more. And I also understand it's changed some over the years as the container industry has tried to make their containers more spill-proof.
Where was the freighter headed?
It was heading from Hong Kong to Tacoma, Washington.
So it had picked up these toys in Asia mm-hmm. to bring to the United States. Mm-hmm. And looking down from a plane, would I have been able to see what had happened?
Well, this is part of what I wanted to do when I first heard about the story was try to be able to reconstruct it as a kind of, I guess, mock adventure story. So it begins with a kind of a disaster of this spill. And so I try to find out what would it have looked like after the ship had sailed beyond the horizon and the storm had calmed. And we do know that within 24 hours or so, the packages, the glue would have dissolved and the plastic shell would have separated from the cardboard back and released the four species of bathtub animal onto the sea. And I imagine it that if we were flying over in a low-flying plane, it would have looked like confetti exploding in slow motion across the waves. So I imagine it.
Well, you said there were four different species, although all of the news reports just talk about the ducks.
Yeah.
And your piece is titled Moby Duck, so you've joined in on that. But I guess that's part of the popular culture, and that's the reason we would talk about rubber duckies, even though we're really talking about plastic, other things.
It's a funny thing. Maybe it seems like a trivial question at first, but it is a peculiar phenomenon. If you go through as I did, reading all the news reports about it and the two children's books that have been written about it, there is this tendency to want to turn all these four different plastic bathtub toys into the rubber duck. So I think it's the rubber duck has become so iconic that people think the story's better.
Well, there are a lot more species of novelty ducks than there are of real ducks.
Yeah, there are 142 species, I believe, of Anatitae, which includes geese, swans, and ducks. And one serious rubber duck collector I spoke to estimated that there's got to be at least 5,000 novelty rubber ducks.
So what happened to these animals after the spill? I'd imagine that the water did real damage to them, that some of them must have sunk to the bottom of the sea.
And so would I have thought that. And it seems that we know that at least a large portion of them didn't, because they drifted across the Gulf of Alaska and started sprinkling the shores of the Alaskan Panhandle.
Landing singly, or were there vast bunches of them?
There was Thanksgiving. I'm trying to make sure I get my dates right because I've reconstructed it. Thanksgiving 1992, there were a party of beachcombers near Sitka, Alaska, went out and first spotted one animal, and then somebody spotted another, and lo and behold, there were dozens.
So we're talking about 10 months later. These things start popping up.
Yeah.
Was it all that far from where they had spilled off the ship?
I think it's 2,000 miles, if I'm remembering my numbers.
So they swam quite a bit, but that's still a slow trip, 10 months.
Yeah, and I hope that the figures add up here in my head here, but it's 7 miles per hour, I believe. No, it can't be quite right. It might be 7 miles per day that they drift across. So it's slow, but they make it.
My guest is Donovan Hohn, H-O-H-N. His article, Moby Duck, or The Synthetic Wilderness of Childhood, is in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. So the reaction, as you said, was quite strong. There are two children's books, including 10 Little Rubber Ducks by Eric Carle, one of the most popular children's book writers. How accurate were all of the stories?
You know, the basic story, and there's Carl in his book introduces his children's fable with a little news clip titled Rubber Ducks Lost at Sea, and the basic gist of it is right. It says 29,000 rubber ducks spilled overboard, drifted into the Arctic, which I think is an element of the story that also captured the imagination, the idea of some of the ducks at least making it into the Arctic. So the reporting was accurate. It just struck me repeatedly that the fact, even in that headline in Carl's book, it's Rubber Ducks Lost at Sea. So why is it that particular slightly more fabulous version of the story is the one that people like to retell. It seemed almost to become a kind of, it's not urban, but a kind of a legend.
And it led some people to actually try to find out the true story. A high school teacher, Evan Punderson, tried to track down the source of the spill. Yeah. How do you go about doing that?
Punderson really is, he's the first detective at the scene. He's there before the newspaper's stories. He was writing for a wonderful local newspaper in Sitka called the Sitka Daily Sentinel, part-time while teaching high school. And when he heard about these beachcombers first discovering the toys, he placed an ad in the classified section of the Sentinel and asked that anyone who'd found toys contact him. And people did. Up and down, hundreds of miles up and down the Alaskan coast, people started calling them in.
But only Alaska? Did none of them turn up closer to the spill? Did none of them wind up in Asia?
A few years later, some had looped back around and hit an Aleutian island near the site of the spill. A few years after that, some turned up on the coast of Washington State, south of Seattle. So they did keep on traveling, and discoveries have continued to be made.
I've heard of some in Kennebunk, Maine. Is that possible?
Well, this was the when I first started doing the research, there had been the company that made the toys had actually put out a reward for anyone who found a toy in the summer of 2003. On the coast of New England, because projections suggested that that's where some of the toys would go, across the Arctic, down along the east coast of Maine. And in fact, I think that was the idea that first excited me. I kept on imagining walking along the seashore somewhere in New England and looking out, and I just had this vision of a drift of yellow ducks invading, which turned out to be totally wrong. They didn't show up in multitudes, and it's questionable whether they made it at all. There was one tantalizing sighting that seems somewhat credible, but still questionable.
So this would have been the Northwest Passage going from the Pacific to the Atlantic.
Yeah, exactly, which is just... Well, it's wonderful.
Well, all of those explorers in the 16th century couldn't do it, but maybe a rubber ducky could.
Yeah, and in some ways there's even some scientific value to the data of the rate at which they would have transited the Northwest Passage.
How did you wind up writing about this spill?
Well, it's actually a part of the – it didn't quite make it into the piece because I wrote way too much and it had to get cut, but the – I teach English at a high school here in New York, and it was one of the assignments I give is I ask students in a nonfiction class to investigate an artifact. And it was actually one of my students, a young man named Evan, who's now trying to become a sports writer, who came across the story doing his research and reading about it in his essay. I wrote him like two or three pages of comments. Envisioning how he should revise and what he should add and it ended up being that I was writing the proposal for what I wanted to do. So at the end of that year, I asked him if he minded if I keep going on the hunt, and he said yes.
My guest is Donovan Hohn, H-O-H-N. His article, Moby Duck or the Synthetic Wilderness of Childhood, is in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Donovan Hohn. His article, Moby Duck, or the Synthetic Wilderness of Childhood, is featured in the current issue of the Harper's Magazine. In fact, there's a beautiful picture of a yellow duck with orange-painted beak. Although I suspect that most of the ducks were stripped of their paint when they arrived.
Well, the four animals that were known as the packaged as floaties was how their manufacturer called them.
And what were the four animals?
A red beaver, a green frog, a blue turtle, and a yellow duck. None of them actually were painted. They were made to be. I actually interviewed the developmental a psychologist and pediatrician, T. Barry Brazelton at Harvard, who had been involved in researching the quality, doing kind of quality testing of the toys that the first years a company were making, and he said part of the goal of these toys was that they would be affordable. So they were inexpensive plastic, hollow plastic toys with no painting on them whatsoever.
How much plastic is produced globally each year?
The figures that I have say that it's around, that we consume 200 million tons of plastic annually, a large amount of plastic.
And how much winds up in the sea?
Well, that's a question I don't think anybody can answer. Visible quantities, so many that a quasi-judicial commission in California estimates that there's 46,000 pieces of visible plastic floating in every square mile of the ocean.
Wow. There's something called a plastic plankton soup.
There's a researcher named Charlie Moore in California, who has done now two expeditions, actually, where he goes trawling for plastic in the center of the North Pacific, taking samples in a very fine mesh net, and discovering there that there are now 6 pounds of plastic for every 1 pound of zooplankton.
And how does this plastic wind up getting into the oceans? Spills like this may be too common, but they're still fairly rare.
If it's not ending up in a landfill, plastic it floats. It doesn't biodegrade, and it can eventually wash through sewage systems, through runoff, through beach trash, eventually end up in the sea if it's small enough to get through the grates.
And I read about an albatross a dead albatross that turned out to have plastic in its system. So I guess it's also going into fish. It's going into all the animals that feed at sea.
I think this is the part of the story that the scientists I spoke with who are concerned about the plastic pollution of the sea. And I didn't realize I was going to be reporting an environmental story when I set out, but worry about the quantities of plastic that are entering into the food chain at sea.
But the oceans have always been the favorite dumping ground of man, haven't they?
Sure.
Haven't they always been polluted? What's the difference now?
Yeah, in some ways, the hero of the piece, one of the scientists I spent the most time with, a guy named Curtis Ebsmeyer in Seattle, explained to me that if, in fact, if you think of the toxins released by a volcano, natural pollution of the sea is often worse than man-made. But the difference, according to Ebsmeyer, is that eventually things either degrade or sink, with the exception of plastic. He says that 60% of plastics float, and in theory will never sink. They just get smaller.
The albatross had 700 specimens of plastic in its body.
Yeah, these were naturalists out on the in the middle of the North Pacific, recovered this carcass of a Laysan albatross, which is apparently the Laysan albatross is the most voracious eater of plastics, because they mistake it for squid and their other natural food sources that float near the surface. For whatever reason, they end up eating a lot of plastic. And in this one specimen, they found 700 different plastic items, including intact cigarette lighters, bottle caps, plastic shards from who knows what.
So how much of an environmental story did this turn out to be? I mean, there are a couple of environmental stories. There's the obvious one, the way the environment works. We have the way ocean currents work. They could be pretty predicted. They were predictable, weren't they? But what about all this other stuff?
You know, it's funny with the ocean currents. They can predict them, and they now have state of the art buoys that transmit a radio signal, so you can follow the currents. But those are very expensive, and the currents are constantly shifting. So If you believe the oceanographers who actually studied this data, and one of them was at NOAA, one of them was Ebsmeyer, the fellow I mentioned, they actually think that the data they're getting back from these from following these ducks is of value.
Well, he's a scientist who tracks drifting icebergs for the oil industry, Ebsmeyer. But he also found where some 80,000 Nike sneakers drifted to in a spill in 1990.
Yeah, he was a private oceanographic consultant, and among his clients were oil companies. He studied drifting icebergs. You don't want one of those hitting your oil rig or eddies that swirl.
Or your Titanic, for that matter.
For that matter. So he's retired now, and he's and part of the reason he retired was to devote, I think, himself more full time to what had become his passion, which is following, recovering the data resulting from container spills.
And he edits a quarterly newsletter called Beachcombers Alert.
Yeah,
who would want to read that?
Maybe it's me. I find it an extremely readable newsletter. I think what it is there's a sense of miscellany when you flip through these pages, the oddities and marvels that wash up on shores around the world. Something marvelous about it, the image of things traveling great distances, and then also these things that are crossing our oceans on cargo ships that we don't think about. There's something about them ending up on a beach that makes me think of the things I see in the store differently, too, that they're actually crossing an ocean and can fall off.
Well, there's also that annual Beachcombers Fair in Sitka, is it?
Yeah.
And you went there. What did your wife think about that? Wasn't she due to give birth about that time?
It was not a popular topic. I wanted to write about this story. I called up Ebsmeyer. He said, you've got to come to this Beachcombers Fair in Sitka, Alaska, which is the city on an island off the coast of Alaska where the toys first washed up. And he said every year in July, there's this Beachcombers Fair. He said I could interview people who'd found them and see what else had washed up in the previous year. And he also offered me a spot on a boat that was going to go off to an island searching for flotsam that had washed up. And I'd had visions of breaching whales and rubber ducks on wild shores, and I wanted to write the story. My wife was pregnant, and our son was due to be born on August 1st, and this Beachcombers Fair ended on the 25th, which was cutting it close. She consented in the end,
and it all worked out.
Yeah, it worked out, and she is proud of the results, and it all worked out. Yeah.
My guest is Donovan Hoehn. His article, Moby Duck or the Synthetic Wilderness of Childhood, is featured in the January issue of Harper's Magazine. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You came across a father-son team of beachcombers, Tyler and Dean Orbison. Why do they use flashlights when they're beachcombing?
Yeah, part of the fun of doing this was I liked the idea of going to the places that these ducks had kind of randomly connected. So I met beachcombers in Maine, and I met this pair of beachcombers, a father-son pair of beachcombers in Sitka, who go on these two-week-long beachcombing expeditions up and down the Alaskan coast to remote islands. They said some of the islands they've been to have bunkers from World War II. The islands are now uninhabited. And they started beachcombing in caves, sea caves recently, where the driftwood creates a kind of trap that catches all sorts of things. So they go in there with flashlights, and apparently it's very cold, and they rummage around. And
I bet you they find some pretty old stuff.
They do. They find old stuff. Yeah, they find stuff. There's military equipment from World War II that turns up. And then there's a lot of more recent stuff, but often from very distant places. They find things with Russian characters on them and with Chinese characters on them. It's full of discoveries, which to the naked eye looks like trash, and maybe it is.
Well, one of the more common things in the ocean is styrofoam.
Yeah. Styrofoam is probably, at least when I was speaking with Ebsmeyer's, of all the varieties of plastics, something I didn't personally know much about before I began doing research, trying to make sense of the chemistry of plastics. But styrofoam is foamed polystyrene, which apparently, when it's not foamed, will sink. So styrofoam is particularly noxious to oceanographers or lovers of beaches because it's made to float, and it breaks down into the little spherical bubbles and drifts everywhere.
You wrote that covering the story tells you a lot about how, despite very specific details about events, we crave the fantasy aspect of stories like this.
You know, I think there's, and I didn't set out also to allude to Moby Duck, which seemed perhaps like a foolhardy, Moby Dick, which seemed like a foolhardy thing to do. But there is something, I think, similar for me in the undertaking. There's a chapter in Moby Dick where he goes to New Bedford and talks about how all the candles, even the houses, are in a sense made of blubber, because it was the whale oil was the petroleum of the 19th century. And there's part of that for me too, of wanting to escape from the world of make believe, of not knowing where products come from. I feel in a way that I've lived in a cocoon of advertising and fiction ever since I was born. So it was partly a desire to at least try to peek beyond it,
and to get away from reality, which is that plastic is a key factor in our world. Beachcombers find water bottles more than any other thing. Only 3% of all plastic winds up being recycled.
Yeah, our number was 5%, and it's a hard number to get to, partly because the only plastics that for which there's a recycling industry really at this point is for plastic containers. But there's so much plastic in other products. That's the number we managed to get from various good sources.
And we know that 30,000 of the 4 species of animals went overboard. How many have turned up so far?
I don't think anyone knows the exact number. The Orbisons, this father-son beachcombing team, they have around 120, at least when I spoke with them in 2005. But there were people in Sitka with dozens of them. So I think it's going to be impossible ever to know.
Mm-hmm. But it probably is only a small percentage of the 30,000.
It's certainly.
And the rest is still floating out there or on the bottom of the ocean?
On the bottom of the ocean, caught in Arctic ice.
Would it be better for something to be floating at the surface or at the bottom of the ocean environmentally?
From what I understand, that if it sinks, it's taken out of the food chain. So if the concern is about apparently the particulate plastics, which is what happens to it when it disintegrates, it becomes molecular eventually. It does end up in the food chain through jellyfish, which are some of which are filter feeding and pump the water through their bodies, and then of course eventually are consumed by larger fish and all the way up to tuna and us.
Donovan Hone's Moby Duck, or the Synthetic Wilderness of Childhood, is featured story in the January issue of Harper's Magazine. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.